This episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast is proudly supported by AQA. AQA want you to know about all the things they've put in place to ensure your students' summer 23 GCSE maths exams were the best exams they could be to allow your students to shine. So what did they do? Well, I've picked out four things here that interested me. Number one, multiple choice questions were removed from the beginning of the papers and replaced with some lovely opening settling questions so that even your weaker students could have a go, succeed, and carry that momentum through the rest of the paper. So important, that start of an exam. Number two, the wording, context, and ramping of demand in the questions were all carefully considered. Number three, past questions were looked at scientifically in terms of performance to inform the question choice for summer 23. And finally, AQA have got together with some of the very best assessment expertise for mathematics in the whole wide world who work non-stop to try and get the best possible assessments for you. But that's all well and good, but did it actually work? Well, of course, the results from summer 23 are in, so we can reveal that 60% of foundation tier students achieved half marks or more across the exam, compared to just 33% in 2019 before the pandemic. And in the higher tier, over 65% scored over half marks, compared to 46% in 2019. So it's looking good. Head over to aqa.org.uk/discovermaths to book a call with one of AQA's team of experts and find out why you should consider switching to AQA for GCSE maths. That's aqa.org.uk/discovermaths, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast with me, Craig Barton, a show where I interview people who interest and inspire me from the wonderful world of education. This is the 10th, yep, the 10th in the series of monthly conversations with my good friend and podcasting enemy, Ollie Lovell. Each time we reflect upon three things we've tried, seen, or been thinking about in the last month. This time around, we discussed, firstly, consider failures first as system failures. So good on that from Ollie. Secondly, I share my latest lesson observation and coaching template. Third, we have the mantra of representation, decomposition, and approximation. Fourth, I pitch my idea of two different we-dos so pairs don't copy each other. Then Ollie shares his ideas on tightening feedback cycles. And finally, I confront Ollie with the question, are exit tickets a waste of time? Just a reminder to sign up for my two newsletters, that's the Tips for Teachers newsletter and the ED newsletter, for more educational goodness in your inboxes each week. Links are in the show notes. Enjoy!
Ollie Lovell, how's ever, mate? How are you?
Pretty good, Craig, apart from you making me feel bad this week.
Oh, tell me more. Go on.
Well, you shared this podcast with me about this bloke called Brian Johnson, who's pretty much the healthiest man on earth. And I was listening to it tonight while I was going to pick up my kebabs. And just at the moment that I was going to pick up my kebabs, he's talking about how he doesn't have any carbs, how he doesn't have any fried food, how he eats a completely vegan diet. I pick up my kebabs and I look at them and I'm like, oh, Craig, what are you doing to me? And that's what I was eating because, you know, I was preparing for this podcast, didn't have any time to cook any dinner. You put me in a tough corner there, Craig. But apart from that, it's been great.
Fascinating listen, isn't it, though, mate? So for people who aren't aware, this Brian Johnson, this is, what's he claim? He's the most studied human or something like that in history. So, and he's set himself this goal of essentially beating the aging process. So I think he's 46 or something like that. And he has 50 pills in the morning. He has his bloods done every day. He's trying to supercharge each of his organs. And it was a fascinating listen, though, mate, wasn't it? Hey?
It was very interesting. He reckons he's had, 8 months worth of perfect sleep every night or something like that. He's like, I just wanted to show it was possible, so I did it. Yeah, goes to sleep at, it was 8:30 every night, gets up at 4 a.m. He's a bit of a machine, but yeah.
But I thought you made me feel bad, so I'll come back to you on this one, right? So for people who aren't in Ollie's Patreon, you won't have heard that last time we chatted, we shared our New Year's resolutions. And one of mine was for fitness, which is I want to be able to do 15 pull-ups. I can do about 3 at the moment. And then I just checked my phone the other day, video from Ollie. I thought, oh, what's this? Ollie banging out effort. Well, I'll tell you, a couple of things annoy me about this. So first you banged out, I counted 19 pull-ups that you're doing. After like a full session of climbing, you had to put that bit in there just to rub the salt in the wounds a little bit more. But the bit that annoyed me the most, as I say, I can just about do 3. You're banging your first 5 out and you're chatting to your mate at the side of you, mid doing the first 5 pull-ups. Honestly, I nearly blocked you there. I was absolutely fuming when I saw this. You're good at these though, all right? You're in some shape.
Oh, it's just the climbing. Yeah, I've really been enjoying climbing over the last year or so. And my idea of exercise is something where you don't realize you're exercising. So climbing up a wall is really good because you don't realize you're doing it. It's just fun.
God, that's good. Very good. That's good, mate. Hey, I tell you, I was going to tell you something, actually. We've not had a chance to speak about this, but I think you'll find this interesting. So Isaac, my eldest, he's in his first year at school, reception year. So he's just turned 5. And we've moved him schools at Christmas. It's a long story. But anyway, the school he's in now, I'm saying this is probably my favourite phase of parenting I'm going through now, because he's learning to read, right? And they do a phonics programme at his school called Monster Phonics. And I don't know if you have this in Oz, but honestly, Ollie, it is unbelievable. So he's gone from, so he joined the school in January, and in January he could recognise all his letters and stuff, and he could do like a few kind of tricky words and things, like a few high frequency words. But within the space of about 3 weeks, he can read, like he, and it's mind blowing. So what Monster Phonics does, and from a kind of teaching and learning perspective, it's absolute gold for geeks like us. So it colours in letters. They have these characters. So if a letter's coloured in red, that's angry red A. So anything coloured in red would make the A sound. So if you have like paid, P-A-I-D, the A and the I would be coloured in red. So he knows that's an A sound straight away. And then they have like green froggy. So anything coloured in green would make the E sound. And you have Miss Oh No and all this kind of thing. So what he does, he gets these books and the Monster Phonics books, and the words in them are coloured in with the letters. So he can read anything that's coloured, he can read it. Doesn't matter if it's a 5-letter word, a 10-letter word, because he knows how to decode it. He knows the sounds because he's learned all these colours and these characters. He can read anything. But then what's really nice there is you then give him a word that's just all coloured in black. And sometimes he'll look at it and he'll struggle a bit. And he says, can you give me a hint? And the hint, you just have to say, well, that would be coloured in yellow and that would be coloured in red. And straight away, he's got it. So that's kind of like the scaffolding. But then, of course, the laying after that is you just take all the scaffolding away. And he looks at words and he'll say to me, so that's going to be an angry red A. That's going to be a Miss Ono. That's going to be a Yoo-Hoo. And then he can just read it. And it's just, Ollie, it's absolutely blown my mind. Like, it's for a start, just... as a parent, to see your kid developing is amazing. But from a teaching and learning perspective, I mean, I'm no reading expert or anything, but it is fast. It's just brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. He can read books. Within a few weeks, he can read books. And then he's wanting to write. And when he writes, he colours in all the letters and stuff. It's amazing. So I just wanted to share that with you, because I know you like this kind of stuff, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. That's awesome. That's so great to hear it's working. To me, that's actually counterintuitive. I would have thought that the colours were kind of a bit extraneous, a bit of a distraction from the actual decoding, but maybe they've done it in a way that it really works, and clearly it's working for Isaac, so that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. All right, anyway, we've talked long enough. Let's dive straight in, so yeah, I'm looking forward to this, as I always do. What's your first idea you've got for us today?
My first idea, well, this idea comes from, I originally came across it from Dylan William, which is a good segue into not this first idea, but actually a revisiting of one of the ideas I talked about last time, which, mm-hmm. as I'm sure you remember and you're nodding, Craig, was my kind of challenge to the suggestion of making feedback detective work. And so for those who didn't listen to the last episode, I can't be bothered explaining it, so you better go back and listen to that last episode. But in the meantime, I did manage to actually go and chat to Dylan William, and I was like, Dylan, you know, I'm not 100% sure about this idea. It was kind of a little off-channel chat at the end of the podcast I recorded to him recently. And I'm not convinced by this idea of making detective work, making students kind of work out. I am kind of explaining it now because I realized it was probably mean what I said before. Saying like, there are two things you missed on this page, work out what they are and then find it out. And he said, Ollie, I saw you'd written that question. And so I just wanted to be clear. You should only make feedback detective work if the students aren't motivated for feedback in the first place. The mechanism of it is it helps kids who are maybe not interested in getting feedback and improving. It turns into a bit of a game for them, and suddenly they might be actually paying attention to feedback when they wouldn't have before. If you have a motivated student who actually wants feedback, then don't hide it from them or turn it into a game. Just give them feedback and help them improve as fast as they can. So that's Dylan's take on that.
That's an important subtlety. We talked a little bit about that, how it's potentially a motivating thing, but that's really clear now. So only do it if you don't think the kid's going to respond to that explicit directed feedback. Mm-hmm. That's good. Just a little segue from me here. I listened to your interview. I thought it was fascinating. What's the name of the other guy?
Aaron Hamilton.
Yeah, he was good as well. Hey, I've not come across him before. They're super smart. I'm thinking Ollie's going to be out of his depth here with these two, but you held your own well. No, it was good. Really good interview,
They were great and extremely concise and precise in their answers, which as a podcast host is absolutely fantastic. Yeah. All right. Speaking of being concise, I'll get back to the point. My first takeaway today is treat failures as system failures. Here's two kind of examples to get people thinking about. Imagine there's a playground, kids are playing at lunchtime, kid falls over, breaks their arm. Two ways to approach this, you know, trying to attribute blame. One is to say it's like an individual failure, work out which teacher was on duty and question them about why they weren't paying enough attention, why they were on their phone, whatever it might be. The other thing is to treat it as a system failure and saying what in the environment contributed to this injury, and is there something we can systematically change to reduce its chance in future. You know, a more of a learning related example is a student fails a subject, rather than saying, you know, which teacher did they have, what did that teacher do wrong, it's like, okay, what's our curriculum look like, what's our assessment look like, how frequent is our assessment, and so on. How can we make sure kids don't fall through the gap? So the benefit clearly of treating failures as system failures is the organization is taking ownership rather than individual. It's not a blame game. And this puts the system in a really good position to actually engineer sustainable solutions to a potential ongoing problem. And also you just avoid any kind of morale impacts that it might have on someone. The dark side of this is that if we kind of overemphasize this, we might end up with kind of bloated systems. So, you know, that, I mean, it's great that we've had so many improvements in occupational health and safety over the last 100 years. We don't have people, blokes up the top of skyscrapers, you know, eating their lunch while they're building it and falling off and a couple of people dying a week kind of a thing. But the dark side to that is that, you know, I don't know, you probably can't pick up a 5-kilogram box or something without like a ticket saying you know how to pick up boxes or something like that. So, and yeah, this has broad implications, I think, for life and family life too as well. It's like, oh, we forgot to pick the kid up from school. Oh no, you did a horrible job. Well, actually, can we set up a system to make sure this doesn't happen again? Takeaway one: treat failures as system failures.
Love that. I love that. So that is just, I'll tell you what it's brought to mind. So I was in a school yesterday, and I'm going to talk more about this school I was in yesterday in a couple of my other takeaways. But I saw an interesting example, and I wonder whether this fits into your model of this, right? So there was, I was watching a lesson as part of coaching, it'll be a guy I'll talk about a little bit later as well. But it was a really interesting moment in the lesson where we'd worked the previous day as a department on checking for listening during the modelling phase. So he was really keen to put this into place whilst I was in the room. He said, you know, I'll be crap at it, but I'd rather try to do it whilst you're in the room, then we can chat about it, which is absolutely fantastic. So he's doing the he's doing the modelling, and there's this lad at the back called Reese, and he asked him a question. He basically, I forget what he was, what the actual subject was, but he gave an explanation, and then he said, "Reese, can you explain that back to me? What did I just say?" And obviously, Reese was like, "I've no idea." And he's like, well, why don't you have an idea? And he goes, well, I don't understand it. And he said, well, no, that can't be true, because I'm not asking you to understand it. I'm asking you to kind of show me that you've listened to it. And anyway, he went back and forth and he did a good no opt out. He said, okay, I'm going to come back to you, Reese, in a minute. You better be listening to what I'm saying, and blah, blah. And eventually he was listening. The reason I bring this up is it's interesting where you kind of point the blame. Blame's the wrong word, but it's interesting where you kind of point the blame there. One way is you could say it's Reese's fault. He's just a kid who doesn't listen. Okay. Or to use your kind of framing here, it could be a bit of a systems failure in terms of how that kind of phase of the lesson is set up. So if it becomes the norm that we're all checking for listening all the time, then that simply can't happen, or it's not going to happen as much, because students like Reese will not be able to opt out, will not be able to say they don't know, will not be able to not listen. So I think it's a really interesting framing all that. I think it's all too easy sometimes when a kid does something that we don't want them to do, or like you say, they fail or they underachieve, we blame the kid. But actually, if we look at the systems we've got set up, maybe that's potentially a more useful kind of way to look at it first before just, it's so easy to say, well, Reese will never listen, or that kid will never be good at maths. But actually, if we look at the systems we've got in place, maybe that's a more useful thing. I don't know if that fits into your kind of the way you were thinking about it all.
Yeah, no, that's a really nice application. And I hadn't actually transferred it to the kind of student level and thinking about the system around the student. Because the classroom is a system, as you kind of highlight. And so thinking about engineering that a way to make it as easy as possible for students to act in line with the expectations is a great, great place to take that. Love it.
Good, that all. Love it. All right. Well, should I segue on to mine then from this? Because I think you'll like this. So as you know, I've been sent your best mate, Josh Goodrich. I've been sent his book that I've been reading and loving, and I'm interviewing him tomorrow morning. So I wanted to run by something that I've taken from his book, which I know you've read as well. And I'm genuinely not just saying this. I think it's excellent. I think it's absolutely excellent. You know, you read a lot of books like me, and often you think that could have been a blog post. That could have been a paragraph, in fact, not even, you know, a bloody blog post. But Josh's book is just ram full of insights. So I finished reading it last week, and over the last 2 days I've been in a school. Day one, I did my usual kind of departmental support model where I watched a load of lessons, then I got the whole department together in the afternoon and we worked on something specific. And in this case, it was their explanations. It was doing a bit of check for listening and a bit of whiteboard work on the WeDo. But then day two, which was yesterday, I coached 4 teachers. But also what was nice about that is the head of department asked if she could join me for each of the observations and coaching so she could upskill her own kind of coaching process, which I'm always a big, big fan of. So it meant that we could test out each other's hypotheses and the evidence and so on and so forth. But the reason I'm telling you this is it gave me a perfect opportunity to trial out my latest, get ready for this one, lesson observation and coaching form that I've put together. And this is about iteration number 17 of this, but it's had a big new addition based on Josh's book, right? So I've got it here, and I'll put a copy of this in the show notes or whatever. And I'm interested how this compares to what you might take into a lesson whenever you're observing as part of coaching, right? So in terms of the tech, I do this on an Evernote doc. The reason is I take my notes on my phone and I take a lot of pictures, and I just find Evernote quite easy to kind of insert the pictures and so on. But you can do this pen and paper if you want or whatever. I've also, by the way, as well as pictures, by default now, I tend to hit record on my phone in terms of an audio recording when I come in. Like if I've been working with the teacher for a while, we'll set up the videos and stuff with the clip on mic and all that. But if I'm just walking in, sometimes it's really useful just to hit record with audio. And sometimes we'll use that in the coaching session. Sometimes it'll just be for my own kind of thing that I can then transcribe it and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that's just kind of an aside. That's the tech. I have Evernote and I have a phone. Anyway, what have I got in my Evernote doc? So the first thing is I have teacher context. So if the head of department has told me anything about the teacher, just something as simple as how many years they've been teaching, or if they have something in particular that they've said that they want to work on, just a couple of sentences there just to frame it. Also, maybe something a bit about the lesson or the class, any kind of just broad context there, I'll just do. And I tend to do that. I'll fill that in beforehand, just a couple of sentences for my own point of reference. So that's number one. Number two, my next section, I call it general observations and timings. So as soon as I go into a classroom, the first thing I do is I take a picture of the board and I write down the time when I'm in there and what's happening in the lesson. So the board is a nice visual just to show me what stage of the lesson we're at. And this pictures are really nice to refer to in the coaching session. And also this section will just be where I kind of timestamp everything that's happening. So for example, kids settle down, starting the do now at this time. At this time, teacher starts to go through the answers. At this time, moves on to the explanations and so on. And again, just to kind of jump ahead, when we get to the kind of critical evidence, time I find a really powerful critical evidence thing. Just if you say, I've had a few where I've said to somebody, how long do you reckon that it took you to review the answers? And they'll say 2 minutes. And I'll say, well, actually, I timestamped this. It was 9 minutes. And like, oh, wow. Okay. And that then opens the door to go. So I like to timestamp there. So I've got context, observations and timings. Number three, specific praise. So again, we've talked about this before. This is not your kind of airy-fairy stuff. I liked your questioning. It's, I love that question you asked whoever on highest common factor. So I'm going to pick out two or three really specific things that I liked. Then we have the exciting stuff. So number four, hypothesis. So this is where I'm going to form my kind of theory about something that isn't going as well as the teacher perhaps hopes it is going. And I'll share one of a practical example of all of this in a sec, Ol. Then critical evidence, or some people call it pivotal evidence. So what's the evidence that's either going to support or refute my hypothesis? And that's typically going to be photos, audio recordings, conversations I have with students. It could be data in terms of the number of kids who got something right or the number of the kids who had their hands up, or it could be timings, as we spoke about, or if I'm videoing, then the section of the video. So we've got context, observations and timings, praise, hypothesis, critical evidence. And then here's the new one. This wasn't in there before, and I can't believe this wasn't in there. This is straight hot from Josh's book, diagnostic question. So I love this now. So what I did in the past, and again, this is one of those I can't believe I did this, is in the coaching session, I'd start with specific praise, and which is fine. And then I'd say, okay, here's my hypothesis. And I'd do the hypothesis and the evidence, and it always went fine. But reading Josh's book, like, I'm mad to do that, because Josh makes the point that in order to know which way to kind of direct the coaching, you need to know the strength of the coachee's mental models. And a really good way to do this, or the only way to do this, is to ask them a diagnostic question. So that might be as simple as something like, tell me about the phase of the lesson where you reviewed the answers. Or it may need to be a little bit more directed, like, how many of your kids got question one right, as I'll talk about in a second. But getting a sense of a teacher's mental model, then according to Josh's frame, which I fully buy into, if that mental model is weak, so the teacher just kind of does a surface level description or can't identify the problem, then that suggests to me as a coach, I'm going to need to be a bit more directive. I'm going to need to tell them what I think and what they should do. But if their mental model is strong and they say, ah, yeah, you know what? At the moment, I knew that wasn't going as well as it should. And I think it's because this and this, this and this. Then we can move to a bit of a more collaborative approach to moving towards the solution. So that diagnostic question is the biggie that I've inserted in there. And having tried it out yesterday, it's a game changer in terms of how it's improving this coaching. And then the final part of the process is just suggested action. So I'll jot this down in the lesson of what I think our next step should be. What's the strategy that's going to solve the problem or help start solve the problem? And then that will kind of lead us into rehearsal and so on and so forth. So just to recap my seven things, something about context in there, general kind of observations and timings, specific praise, hypothesis, critical evidence, diagnostic question, and suggested action. So I'll just give you one little example of this, if that's all right, Ol, then I'll shut up and you can ask me questions. So I was observing a guy yesterday, Andy. He'd been teaching for a while, quite an experienced teacher. My general observations when I went in the room, I took a photo of his board. He had his Do Now on the board, so I took a quick snap of that. I wrote down here, 11:22, most kids in the room, door closed, 11:27, start going through the answers of the Do Now, so on and so forth. Specific praise, really good use of mini whiteboards so he could see the answers of all kids. Excellent check for listening with Reese that I just mentioned in your previous one. He didn't let Reese get away with not listening and so on. Hypothesis. This is where it gets exciting for me. So the way he did his Do Now is the kids wrote, there was three questions in the Do Now, and the kids wrote their working out and answers on the mini whiteboard. And then he said, hover, 3, 2, 1, show me. My hypothesis was, because he had three pieces of data and a load of working out, he's not going to be able to take in all that data and he's going to miss things. It's just too much data. You had 30 kids in the room. You had three pieces of data plus working out. No chance. That was my hypothesis. So, but I need some evidence. So what he said then was, the kids hold their board up and he said, everyone I saw, and I transcribed this because I'd recorded it, everyone I saw remembered, I should tell you what the first question was. So the first question was 132 to the power of zero. So he said, everyone I saw remembered that anything to the power of zero is one. But then what I did is I took some photos of the kids' boards, just the back row, and I found five kids who had answers of zero, had answers of 132, had a load of wrong answers. Okay, so fast forward to the coaching session. So my diagnostic question was, I said to him first, talk me through how you reviewed the answers to the Do Now. So he described it and he said, I use mini whiteboards. And I said, why did you use the mini whiteboards? And he said, so I could see the answers to all the kids. And then he started going off in a bit of a tangent, telling me about question three and blah, blah, blah. So I thought, right, I need to steer him a bit here. So I said, okay, let me be a bit more direct here. How many of your kids got question one correct? And he said, almost all of them, maybe one or two didn't. And I said, right, okay, so my hypothesis was, because of the way you'd set your boards up, that maybe you weren't going to be able to tell how many kids got it right. And here's some photos. So I showed him photos of the boards. And honestly, he was like, and you've experienced it, you've talked about this yourself. It's the moment in the coaching session where you get that buy-in, because he's like, yeah, you're right. And you're not doing it as a gotcha. You're not doing it as like I'm the best, blah, blah, blah. And it's all about how you present it. But it was like, without those photos, without the pivotal evidence, that could have been the end of the conversation. He could have said, well, I think they all got it. I could have said, well, I don't think. And then where do we go from there? But then he was like, all right, okay, so let's solve this problem. So then we moved into setting the boards out. And then it was great, Al. You'd have been proud of me here. So what I would have done 6 months ago is I would have said, all right, so you know what you need to do. All the working out on one side. And then you say to the kids, copy your answer to question one onto the other side of your board. 3, 2, 1, show me. Does that make sense? And that would have been the end of the coaching session. But of course, you know what I'm going to do now. We rehearsed it. So I was a kid. The head of department was a kid. We did all our answers. He then stood up and he talked us through the instructions for how we were now going to do it with our boards. He got us to hover the boards. He got us to hold them up. We purposely wrote a bit small. So then he was like, he changed his instruction to make sure he said write nice and big. And it was brilliant. So I'm really happy with where that's at now for my structure for observations and coaching. And as I say, that's thanks for you, to Adam Boxer, to Josh and so on. And it seems to be working well. So I just wanted to share that with you. And again, if you have any reflections, and I'm particularly interested how that's similar or different to what perhaps you would take into a lesson that you're watching.
That's awesome, Craig. So a couple of things. One, Josh's book helped me to have that realization as well. The importance of what you're calling a diagnostic question to identify the mental models of the teacher. Because that's what allows you to be responsive in your coaching, right? If without checking for that understanding, you're either going to be telling them something they already know, or you might be assuming that they know something that they don't. So yeah, that's great, and I'm so glad you got that out of there. In terms of how that differs, something I'm really keen for you to do in your podcast with Josh is actually, because what StepLab's meant to be is like the distillation of all that theory into like a basically a pro forma like you've created for yourself. So I would love for you in your chat with Josh to get up the StepLab pro forma and have and see if you feel that it captures all the insights from the book, and if there's anything that you think we should change to improve the platform to make it easier for people to coach more effectively. Like, I think that would be a really good stimulus for a deep conversation in your chat, and like that would be awesome for us to make sure that what we've got is as good as it can be. In relation to that, like, I think there's probably some things to draw out that I'll leave for you and Josh to draw out. But there is one thing that I can say, you know, little teaser for people to make sure they listen to that episode. But there's one thing that I can say, you might be interested in adding like a small tweak to what you've got, which is already fantastic. And that is, again, relates to the checking of the mental models, but it's the checking of the mental models in relation to the praise. So, and this is particularly important for you because you're not necessarily coaching the same people for extended periods of time. So when you praise someone, something we've got in the StepLab Proforma is, we call it praise and prompt. So you praise, but then you prompt reflection with a question like, what's the impact of that on students' learning? Or why is that such an important thing to do? And when you ask that question, you're actually getting a sense of whether maybe the teacher didn't even know that they did that thing, right? Maybe they did it, but they just did it out of habit. They don't know why it's important. And if they don't know why it's important, one, they might change it in a way that renders it ineffective in future, or two, they might just stop doing it because they don't really see the point of it. So if you add that in, that will enable you another diagnostic point to delve into the mental models of those teachers as well.
Just literally updated it now on the program. So that's in there now. Praise and prompt, love it all. Yeah, I'll tell you what, just on the interview with Josh, honestly, every page I've got a question, right? And it's, you'll have been there yourself when you're trying to kind of prep to interview a guest. I could literally do 10 hours with him on this because I want to talk about every single aspect of it. And it's just trying to find the one thing. You don't want him to just kind of talk you through the entire book because that's no good for anybody. And it's trying to find that structure and that way in, and trying to also, I've got the kind of elephant in the room that you've done one of the best ever podcasts I've ever listened to with him, and it was a bloody two-parter as well. So I don't want to assume listeners have listened to that, but at the same time, if you've listened to that, I want to make sure there's something new in there. It's an interesting challenge, but I'm looking forward to it. But yeah, I think I'll talk him through my kind of pro forma and get him to draw the comparisons with the StepLab one. I think that'll be a really interesting thing to do.
That'd be great. How many hours have you got booked in?
We set aside 3, so we'll see.
That's good. I'll put in a good word to ask him to add another 7 for you.
It'd be good. All right, that's great.
I really look forward to listening to that one, mate. Can't wait.
Yeah, me too. All right, okay, Al, what have you got for us for your second one?
All right, so this is another idea. This is actually something I learned off Josh. This is about effective teacher PD, which we've talked about a lot, but it also does relate to effective instruction in the classroom because teaching teachers are teaching students as well. And this is the idea that comes from a paper by Pan Grossman, don't know how to pronounce that. It's called Teaching Practice Across Professional Perspective. And the idea is basically whenever you're trying to help someone develop expertise in a specific domain, a format that can be really helpful is the following: representation, decomposition, approximation. So let me talk you through that. So representation is basically the idea that you show the person what the complete school skill looks like in its entirety. So for example, if we were teaching someone how to coach, which is something, you know, I'm doing in StepLab intensives in a couple of weeks, we're not going to start diving straight into effective praise, right? Because we want to show them what a whole coaching conversation looks like to start off with. So we show them, this is what a coaching conversation looks like. This is a simplified version or an abridged version, but this just helps you to build like a mental schema for the kind of what we're going to be covering today or in this training or whatever it might be. Decomposition is then where you actually break that down and you say, okay, so the first thing we did there was praise. This is what effective praise looks like. This is what makes it effective. Here are some of the success criteria. Here are some examples and non-examples. Here's some of the evidence behind it. Here's a worked example. Now you try, kind of a thing, right? So you've got your representation, you've got your decomposition, breaking that down, and then approximation is that key rehearsal part. Now, this sounds simple, and it's all things that we've talked about in the past on this podcast before, but I consistently find myself forgetting at least one of them when I'm designing things. So this is just like a kind of checklist that I go through whenever I'm designing anything, because I really find it helps me. So, I mean, some common errors that I see in PD more broadly are often they stop at representation. They'll show you what quality looks like or what their idea of quality looks like, and they'll be like, this is it, great, PD over. Another issue is jumping straight into decomposition. So you kind of, and this happens in the classroom as well. It's like, oh, I'm going to teach you how to do this algorithm today. Here's step one, without providing the context. Now, in some cases, that can be effective. Often most effective if you do actually need to kind of spread it. It's so cognitively demanding, you need to spread it over a couple of lessons or something. You might say, let's just learn this one skill. But you'd want that one skill to kind of make sense in and of itself. If it's kind of too detached, then it's going to be very hard. And again, thinking about the kind of schema that the learner has in their head and whether they're going to be able to securely affix this to some sort of prior knowledge. And if they don't, that makes that initial representation even more important. And of course, the most common error in PD that I see is the missing approximation. There's no opportunity to begin to apply it or rehearse it or things like that. So yeah, that's just a framework, a short and sharp and sweet framework that I found really helpful. Representation, decomposition, and approximation.
Love it all. Again, we both love a framework, right? And the simpler, the better. So that's really, really good. So two reflections on this. I'm the same as you. I forget at least one of these regularly, or I certainly did. I'm trying to get a little bit better. So the first is, and I know we disagree on this, right? So you know, I love a bit of silent teacher, right? When I'm first doing a worked example, and I know you have your doubts about this, but I'll tell you one of the reasons I like doing silent teacher. So for listeners who aren't aware, when I first do a worked example, I first model it in its entirety in silence. That for me kind of ticks the representation box. It's a way for the kids to see the full thing before then I start narrating and checking for listening of each of the phases. Now, of course, you could kind of do that, but as soon as you start talking through a model, you're essentially jumping into the decomposition. So I just think there's something about that 30 seconds of seeing it from start to finish without me kind of chipping away at it that gives kids the sense of the full picture before we start kind of talking through and decomposing it. And then, of course, everyone listening to this will always do the approximation when they're doing the worked example, because that's your check for understanding, that's your we do, and so on and so forth. So that was the first thing. I just wanted to relate it to perhaps some modelling in the classroom and try and provide a bit of justification for silent teacher. Second thing, then I'll shut up. So just talking about checking for listening. When I do PD on checking for listening, I have this slide where it's a dialogue that I kind of transcribe from a teacher about who was teaching the kids angle properties of an isosceles triangle. And it starts off with a picture of an isosceles triangle. And then the teacher says, this is an isosceles triangle. And then the next thing they say is, what type of triangle is it? Pause, Ben. And then the next line is, what type of triangle is it? Pause, Sophie. And then it's, this is an isosceles triangle. In an isosceles triangle, two of the angles are equal. And then there's a check for listening there. Anyway, there's about kind of eight lines of this. Now, the mistake I made this 2 weeks ago, and it's, again, now I've got this framework, I'm not going to make this mistake again, is I started breaking that down straight away, right? So I'd say, okay, so the first line of dialogue, and I'd animate it so they couldn't even see the rest of it. So the only thing on the screen would be, this is an isosceles triangle. So I'd stop there and I'd say, okay, so notice this is going to set up a check for listening. It's not saying what type of triangle is it. It's doing the explain part first. And then I'd show the next line of dialogue and say, all right, notice now we're checking for listening. We're also doing a cold call. It's a good cold call because there's wait time in there. It's a good cold call because the name comes after the question. So I'd analyze each line. But having heard that framework now, and I was thinking about this myself at the time, this isn't quite working. I think by far and away the best thing to do is just show them the entire exchange. Just give them a bit of time to take that in. And then we can start to analyze each of those lines. So I was skipping out the representation phase of it. I was straight into the decomposition before they'd seen the whole picture. So I think that's kind of the opposite problem that, same problem that I have if I skip out the silent teacher of the worked example. I think I skip out the representation. And then the final thing I said, and I promise I'll shut up. Yeah, every CPD session I do now, it is rehearsal central, and I'm not apologetic about it. My kind of three phases of rehearsal have been, that is the worst idea I've ever heard, so I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do it, but I'm going to apologize to teachers. And now I'm like, no, this is the best thing ever. Like, what? Why would you not do it now? So the day before yesterday, when I did the departmental support, they were all stood up. They were rehearsing left, right and center. They were giving each other feedback. It's an absolute game changer. So yeah, they're my kind of three reflections. So silent teacher, I think, kind of ticks the representation box. When I do my PD on checking for listening or just generally, I'm going to show them the whole thing first and then we're going to break it down. And then, yeah, it's all about rehearsal. Over to you all.
Like it. Thanks for turning my own framework on me to try to convince me about silent teacher there. I love that. Do you know what we should do? I think we should do an experiment.
Go on.
Using silent teacher. I reckon we should give it a crack. I think Tino Endres and Alexander Renkel would be very interested in this. It's very related to cognitive load theory. Like, there's a big CLT overlay there. Mm-hmm. Cognitive load theory conference coming up in November in Australia. We could get you out to share some of the initial ideas. And I'm sure there are some schools listening who would be happy to kind of run a little study and find out and help contribute to that research and also involve their teachers in some research.
I've got another name to throw to you now. So I've made a connection. Do you know the work of Bethany Rittle Johnson? So she does load of stuff. So me and her are best mates now. So I was, if she's listened to this, we're not best mates, but fingers crossed she's not. But we were doing as part of my work with ED, we've got this kind of big research grant. So we're doing some work on misconceptions in maths. And again, she was just on the call and she's super smart. So she loves a bit of self-explaining and misconceptions and examples with maths as well. So I'd love to test out silent teacher, you know, because as you say, there's kind of two ways of looking at it, right? Like, for me, the reason I do it is for the representation. It creates a sense of focus in the room that I don't think you get when you're talking. The kind of stakes are a bit lower because the kids know they're not going to be asked questions, but they just get an opportunity themselves without having to listen, without having to verbalize things, just to try and piece things together in their mind. So that's the reasons I do it. But again, your reasons not to do it, particularly with your knowledge of kind of cognitive load theory and the importance of the words and the image and so on and linking things together. It's an interesting one. I'd love to do some proper research on it. It'd be fascinating.
Great. And so my trajectory with silent teacher is, what a horrendous idea. Why would anyone want to do that? To oh, maybe that's actually not a bad idea. I'd need to see some evidence, but I'm definitely see the plausibility of it. To watch this space.
Watch this space. Good. I like it. All right. It's good. That's good, that, mate. All right. Should I do my next one?
Yeah, please.
Right. So this is an idea. So you are my kind of testing ground for ideas, right? So before I unleash them on the world, I think I'll run them by Ollie, see what he thinks. Now, this idea, I don't know if it's a terrible... There's a good chance it's bad, this, right? But let's just see. So if you remember from, God knows, we've done 10 of these now. So this may have been episode 1 or 2 or something.
Have we really done 10?
Yeah, it's good, hey? Yeah. Wow. Our target, we committed to like doing 3 or something like that. So this is episode 10. Wow, good, isn't it? Nearly a year. I know.
Almost our 1 year anniversary, Craig. That's how are we going to celebrate it?
That's our party time. Right. My framework for doing worked examples now is this. So the I do, I lead it, and I check for listening. So I never ask a question of a child that I haven't already told them the answer. The reason for that being, there's a few reasons. Efficiency, kind of speed. I see this kind of hybrid. I'm going to write about this, but I see lots of worked examples that are kind of hybrids where the teacher does a bit of instruction, a bit of check for understanding, a bit of check for listening. It always goes wrong. It always kind of spirals out of control. So I'm going to take the lead, but I'm going to check the kids are listening. So that's the I do. The first we do is a step by step. So the first we do is where I say to the kids, get your mini whiteboards. The only thing I want you to write down is the first line of working. So if it's adding fractions, the only thing I want you to write down is what's the common denominator of these two fractions. Next thing, the only thing I want you to write down is what are we going to multiply this fraction by to make it equivalent to this fraction. And the reason I do that is I need to diagnose exactly where in the process the kids are going wrong. If they are going wrong, I don't just want a load of final answers and then I have to play detective. I want regular checks on the whiteboard for each step of it. And also the kids feel super successful if they do that. If a kid gets step one wrong, I can get them back on track and then maybe they can get steps 2, 3, 4, and 5 right, and so on. So phase one is an I do with checking for listening. Phase two is a step-by-step on the whiteboards. And then phase three, as we've spoken about as well, is Adam Box's tick trick. So I call this a start to finish. So the kids will do another example in their books or in the whiteboard. It doesn't matter. They do the whole thing from start to finish. And then when I review the answer, I'll say, okay, if, let's go back to adding fractions. If you've got a common denominator of 30, give yourself a tick. If you've remembered to write the thing that we multiply the fraction by to get them equivalent, give yourself a tick. And this forces the kids to not just look at the final answer, but to look at each step of their working and so on. So I'm super, super happy with this framework for worked examples. I'm really happy with it. The I do, the step by step, and then the tick trick or start to finish, as I call it. But, one thing I've noticed, and you'll have spotted this as well, when kids do things kind of on mini whiteboards and in books, you inevitably get kind of a convergence. So if kids are going to go wrong, if a kid's got a wrong answer, there's a real safe bet that the kid next to him's also got the same wrong answer, right? Because it's very easy when kids are writing on mini whiteboards to have a little look at the person next to you and be a bit influenced by them and so on. And you can reduce that to a certain extent by the kids hovering and the messaging you give and so on and so forth. But it's the same when kids do things in books. Like, it's very hard to resist having a look at the person next to you and so on in books. And that's fine because it's good for kids to collaborate, but it reduces the validity of that check for understanding, particularly in the initial stages when you're doing the modeling. So that is all the preamble for a little variation I want to experiment with, but I want to get your take on it first, right? Everyone does the same I do, because there's no way you can change that. Everyone does the same step by step for the second thing, but then you have two versions of the start to finish, two different we do questions, whatever you want to call it, the kind of third example in this trilogy. The kids closest to the window in a pair does one version, the kid closest to the door in the other pair does the other version. They each do it, okay? And then what they do is they swap books, and the tick trick, they tick each other's as they go through it. Now, why would you do this? Okay, there's a couple of reasons. One, the big one, it stops the copying. So it potentially makes that check for understanding more valid, because the kid, assuming they're sat in pairs, the kid's got no one to kind of help them with that, so that they're on their own. The other reason is, I think, and this is a hypothesis, but I think kids take a bit more care how they set work out when they know it's going to be looked at by somebody straight away, whether it's a peer or a teacher. I think there's tremendous value in kids seeing how other kids set things out, particularly, again, early on. It forces students perhaps to look a bit more closely at someone else's work than maybe they would at their own work, take it a bit more seriously and so on. Now, the downsides of it is you're going to need to plan an extra example, and you're going to need to go through the answers of another example. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You know, it's just an extra exposure to something. It's an extra minute or 90 seconds. So I just wondered what you think about that. So just to recap, everyone's doing the same model. Everyone's doing the same step by step. But the start to finish, the first example they do on their own from start to finish, there's going to be two versions of that knocking around that pairs are going to do independently. Then they're going to swap books for the tick trick element. What do you think, Ol?
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea. It's one of those things where the key question is, do the benefits outweigh the increased workload for the teacher, right? So I would say, like, in principle, I think that if someone was designing a maths program that was going to be scaled across the country and they had resources and people hired to create it, like, this is something that I would like seriously test and and, you know, not be surprised if it showed that it was really effective and therefore use it. Similarly, if you're working in a school that has like a centralized curriculum and that's already established and you like it, I think it would be really worthwhile, please someone do this and like report back to us, giving it a crack for a few lessons. And if you had a couple of two different classes, you could kind of run a mini experiment or something and then report back. I guess the question is, because it is, I mean, usually, to be fair though, there's like the textbook will have a couple of questions that you could use. But then you do need to be really clear, especially if you're using the tick trick, or the start to finish as you're calling it, or the tick with me as we call it on StepLab.
Tick with me, that's good.
Tick with me, yeah. If you're doing that, then you do need to be explicit, and there's going to be a time cost there as well. But I think it's I think it's really worth thinking about, and I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, it's just, I'm a massive whiteboard fan, but honestly, whenever you see the kids hold the whiteboards up and you spot a kid who's got something wrong, you can bet a decent chunk of money that kids around them have also got that thing wrong. And it just makes me think, particularly in this early phase of the modeling process, we just need that. That feels like a significant problem. And this is potentially a way to address that. And some kids are doing it deliberately, but some kids just can't help but see what the person next to them has done. And then they're like, oh, of course it's that. Or, you know, and it just feels like we need to do something about that.
Yeah, I think I have a sneaking suspicion that if a school invested equivalent time in building a culture in which students really understand the importance of doing the work themselves, as it would take to create two instead of one question for every question in every maths level in every year, I think it would take less time and effort to do the former, and I think it would have a greater, longer-term impact on those students.
I agree, but what I'm thinking more of is, so let's imagine me and you, right? So we're sat next to each other. Somebody's given us the same example to do. You do it, I'm doing it, and I just happen to catch a look at yours, and I see you've got a different answer, and then I think, of course, Ollie's got it right there. And I think, well, of course, I'm going to kind of change my answer because now I know what the right answer is. Now, best case scenario, that's fine. And I do understand it as well as you understand it. But worst case scenario, the only reason I've got that right is because I've been cued by you. And the teacher assumes that I would have got it right independently. I just think that issue is as significant as the kids deliberately just kind of copying off each other who don't have a clue what's going on. And no matter how good the culture is, I mean, I'm a good kid, but I'm not going to stick with an answer I definitely now know is wrong when I've seen the right way and I now understand the right way. And I don't think that's a thing you can solve with culture, if that makes sense.
I think it is, because I think if a learner understands the importance of doing something themselves, then they would resist that urge. Like, you know, they might, I've seen kids doing this, you know, holding their hand in front of their eyes to stop them from looking at their partner's work, right? Because those particular students know that it's important. I think it can be solved. And like, yeah, it's a hypothesis that if you invested equivalent effort in building that culture versus the thing, that it would have an equivalent impact. But I don't know that for sure, and it probably depends upon the initial context and the students you're working with. But I am also more attracted to the kind of cultural and educational solution to that problem than the engineering solution. But doesn't mean I'm right.
It's good. Love it. All right. I'll keep persisting with that. Maybe get some teachers to test that out and see what's happening. All right.
Yeah, it's a great
idea. Nice one, Ol. What's your final idea you've got for us?
This final idea is just the idea of tightening feedback cycles. And this has popped up in my life in a number of ways over the past month or so. Really, three ways it's popped up. The first is just working on some different kind of class, working with some different teachers on maths programs and talking about assessments and just really working towards and recognizing the value of like increased frequency of assessments, as long as you do have time to act on it and, you know, trying to make them not like too laborious to mark or whatever it might be, make them low stakes, etc. But just the more frequently you're checking for understanding, I mean, you know, and we can think about it as a spectrum. We move from like an end of year test or end of semester test to an end of unit test, to an end of week test, to a check for understanding within the lesson, to a check for listening when you're actually giving the explanation at the start. The more you can tighten those cycles, the earlier you can catch things falling through the gaps. Somewhere where people might not have applied this analogously is to teacher professional development. So we've got, you know, the number of schools I talk to who are like, oh yeah, we do coaching. People set a goal at the start of the year, and then someone comes and sees them at the end of the year. They think about if they've achieved their goal. It's like that feedback cycle is so long. Most people have forgotten what they were meant to be working on by the end of it. Like 90% of teachers, not more. So that's another part. And another part, and this is one that we talked about in part of the bonus part for patrons, in a previous one. This year, I've moved from kind of a yearly reflection. I used to, like, I have a daily tracker and I track various habits like exercise, reading, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What time I get up and go to bed, blah, blah. I used to like set that at the start of the year and try to stick to it for a year just because, you know, it's a New Year's resolution, right? And one of my insights that I shared with you last time was, hold on, why am I doing this yearly? That's crazy. I should be doing it on shorter time frames. And so I've decided to do it monthly and review it and actually change it every month. And so I've changed it after January, and February's been like on two things that I really wanted to improve, like how much reading I'm doing every day and whether or not I'm doing Anki every day, my spaced repetition card system, flashcard system. I've improved because just having that pause point at the end of 1 month to think, am I trying to do too much? What can I cut out? Let's have a look at the data. What did I miss? How can I increase improve the habits around those things? And so, yeah, like three areas in the classroom, in terms of teacher development, and even in like trying to build your own habits, I've found that just simply tightening feedback cycles is a massive lever you can pull to improve what's going on.
Oh, it's good old. Right, okay. So, yeah, it's an interesting one, this. So when I visit schools, I start with a big sit down with the head of department, and we talk through things, and often they show me the schemes of work and curriculum and so on. And I'm obsessed with checking for understanding. And like you say, not just long term, but also not just kind of short term in the moment. So just kind of sketching out there with a pen, and I think you essentially said this, but just to kind of double down on this, we can go for kind of checking for listening when we're given instruction. We can go for checking for understanding almost kind of straight after that instruction to check whether you can kind of apply what we've talked about. We can go for checking for understanding later in the lesson. Teaser, that's what I'm going to talk to you about for my final one. Then we've got kind of what I call retrieval opportunities, where my big four would be weekly low stakes quizzes, homeworks. Geez, what the hell are my other ones? Starters, so the do now, and then what interwoven into kind of future topics. Then you've got kind of end of unit tests, and then you've got the kind of high stakes test at the end of the year. And all of these will give you data of understanding, but you take any one of those out and you're in a bit of trouble. So I'll show you what I see quite a lot. So checking for listening, I rarely see, but then once I've kind of spent the day, because it's my kind of current obsession, and I realize if the kids aren't listening, everything else is a waste of time. Teachers can get that sorted fairly quickly. The checking for understanding, I'm still adamant that the mini whiteboard for the maths teacher, I can't see a reason why you wouldn't. Once you overcome the logistics and faff, I don't know how you're going to get a more efficient way to check for understanding and get feedback on whether things have made sense from 30 kids in a class. Retrieval opportunities is a really interesting one. That's often the gap, you know, that I find in schools. That it goes from, once they nail it within the lesson, it's still then, let's go straight away to the end of unit test, because we've got data in the lesson that kids have nailed it. But this is the classic learning versus performance issue. Without those scheduled in retrieval opportunities, you're in a bit of trouble. But here's the issue, right? This will blow your mind all. So if we go back to those retrieval opportunities, low stakes quiz, I'm a big fan of. So that would be like every week, 10 questions on topics kids have encountered in the past. Kids will do it in the lesson. We'll mark it in the lesson. We'll do the review card idea that I nicked from you years ago. Great. Problem with that is teachers say, I have no time. Curriculum's too busy, so forget that one. So then you move to homeworks. I was in a school recently, I won't say where it was. They do an online homework, Sparks, which is one of our online homework platforms. The completion rate, the average completion rate across all year groups was 13%. 13% of kids were doing their homework. And you know which kids it's going to be who's doing it, right? The kids who probably don't need to do their homework. So homework as a retrieval opportunity, for a lot of schools, it's a real problem to get kids to do it. So forget that one. Then you go to the do now. The problem with you do now, again, it's eaten into lesson time. Some kids aren't taking it seriously. Lots of kids are arriving late to lessons. You can't cover as much ground as perhaps you would in something like a low stakes quiz or a homework opportunity. So that's a bit of a problem. So then you're left with weaving in the thing you're studying currently into future units as a way of retrieval. It's fine for negative numbers, fine for decimals. You try weaving in rotations. You try weaving in, you know, Sokotora or whatever it is. It's a lot harder to weave in other things. So that for me is the gap. So you can kind of nail it in the classroom to get, to use your phrase, to kind of tighten up the feedback cycle. You can nail it in the lessons with the checks for listening and the checks for understanding. You can then nail it a bit more long-term with your end of unit tests and your high stakes tests. But without that middle ground, without those retrieval opportunities, you know, like a 2 days later, a week later, a term later, by the time you get to that end of unit test, kids have forgotten it. So again, that's kind of my reflection on that. I'm fully on board with tightening the feedback cycles, but I think it's, my experience has been that middle ground is where things kind of fall apart a bit. I don't know what your take on that is, mate.
Yeah, so to reframe my suggestion in light of your suggestion, be something like, have a variety of feedback cycles or just distribute feedback cycles or something like that. Make sure you have multiple feedback cycles over. It's not quite as catchy, Craig, I must say. But make sure you have multiple feedback cycles across differing time periods and durations to ensure that all bases are covered, something like that.
Yeah. Do you find that though, Al? Like, what do you find, it's that middle ground is where, if problems are going to appear, it's there? Or do you find it somewhere else within that kind of time frame?
Yeah, probably. It's the hardest thing to do. It's like, because it takes the most planning. Like any teacher you can throw up a question from last lesson at the start. There's your do now. Everyone's got to do an end of every lesson and end of unit test. And you know, like you said, you can get some quick wins with checks for understanding, particularly quick checks for listening. But if you want to in a really, really structured way, revisit content. You know, there's a reason why textbooks don't do it. It's because it's really, really hard. And it takes significant planning. And it's a bit of a logistical challenge as well. But like really, and this is what I've always found, you can spend so much less time teaching in the first place if you know you're going to revisit in a structured way. So instead of spending the last 30 minutes of the lesson doing 20 of the same question, you give students 3 questions on it today, and then you give them 3 questions on the next day, 3 questions on it 3 days after that, and so on and so forth. So if you actually in a structured way approach your teaching like that, it's possible. But if you're still in the quote unquote old paradigm of really blocking everything, then it's particularly difficult to do.
Yeah, it's good. Love it. All right, mate, my final one, we're going a bit controversial here, right? Because you, Ollie Lovell, wade into something on Twitter, and I thought, right, I need to bring this up, right? Exit tickets, right? So if you remember, it must have been about 3 weeks ago, maybe 3.5 weeks ago, something like that, somebody posted something on Twitter about exit tickets, wanting ideas for exit tickets, blah blah blah. Straight away, Adam Boxer comes in, because he hates an exit ticket, and he says they're pointless, they're a waste of time. And he tells a story, I think he may have told it in his book, or he certainly told it to me on a podcast once. He said that he was in a school, and that this, I mean, imagine the reaction here, right? So this department had spent so much time planning exit tickets for the end of each lesson that all the staff were going to use. And Adam said to the curriculum leader, but what happens if the kids aren't at the place where the exit ticket's relevant in that lesson? And they didn't have an answer to that, right? Because
expand upon that. What do you mean by that?
So what I mean is, let's imagine that kids weren't there. The worked example and the fluency practice had taken longer than the teacher had assumed that they would, because the kids weren't, the knowledge wasn't as secure as it needed to be. So all of a sudden, they haven't got to the stage in the lesson where the kids are ready for the exit ticket, because perhaps they haven't covered that particular bit of content, right, or perhaps they've only covered one little bit of it. So all of a sudden, this centrally planned resource, which is supposed to kind of drive consistency and high standards across the department, all of a sudden, teachers are like, well, do I use it? Do I not use it? And if, you know, to an experienced teacher, you know, you think on your feet, you're adapted. But as a first-year teacher, I've got this resource that my head of department's planned. I better use it. Oh, wow, my kids don't have a clue what's going on. Where do I go from there? And so on. So my kind of views on exit tickets have been up and down over the years. So when I was a teacher who loved every gimmick going, of course I was loving an exit ticket because they were trendy and they were literally in the form of slips of paper that the kids got. It was there. They had to give it to me to get out of the classroom, like a golden ticket. You can imagine it was all kicking off. You'd take me bloody forever to create them, right? Then whenever I started kind of researching my How Wish I Taught Maths book, I thought, I'm not sure that there's certainly the kind of paper. Basically, I started reevaluating everything that was taking me a long time. I thought, what's the opportunity cost of this? What could I be doing better with that time, both in terms of planning and within the lesson? So then I stumbled upon the idea of, why don't I just ask a diagnostic question at the end of each lesson? Because the kids don't have to do that on a slip of paper or anything like that. I can ask it and I can respond in the moment. I can get that data and I can do something in the moment. Then whenever I kind of became obsessed with mini whiteboards, I thought, well, why run the risk of a kid guessing the right answer? Like, I think diagnostic questions have a real place. And we talked about these last time we spoke. I think I listed 7 different ways I use diagnostic questions, and I've written a newsletter on that people can check out. But certainly, if I want to get a really reliable check for understanding, I think I'm always going to choose an open response question to ask. So let's get it on the mini whiteboards. In my Tips for Teachers book, I wrote about a few different ideas for different types of questions you can ask for exit tickets. You can get kids to generate their own examples, give me 3 examples of a fraction equivalent to 3/4 and so on. But it's tricky, right? And it again goes back to this idea of learning versus performance, that I think it's a really good idea for a teacher at the end of a lesson to get a snapshot of kids' understanding. I think it's quite a smart thing if the last act that happens in that lesson is the teacher gets some valuable data from the kids. And if that data suggests that kids have nailed it, that's a good indication that they can move on the next lesson. But of course, they're going to remember to include it in a retrieval opportunity going forward. If that data suggests the kids haven't got it, then that's good information for the teacher that they need to intervene and reteach or slow down going forward. But I'm just interested where you're at in terms of exit tickets, because they can be a workload nightmare. They can also be, another way they go wrong is if they're a challenge question. So it's the last question is like a challenge one, and then 3 kids get it, the rest of the kids don't. Everyone feels a bit crap about themselves, and I'm not sure what you learn from that. So I'm interested in your view on them just in general, whether you've got a format that you think is more useful than others. And if you think they're a waste of time, what do you do instead, if anything? So where are you at with exit tickets, mate?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would say that I fundamentally agree with the basically, well, you actually didn't talk that much about that I heard about one of the main points that Boxer was making, which is that the best time to assess the learning of the previous lesson is the start of the next lesson, yeah, right? Because yeah, you did talk about learning versus performance, which was what you were alluding to, but just to make that explicit for listeners, I fundamentally agree with that, right? I think that it's much more effective to, at the start of the next lesson, run something and touch up your students' understanding after they've done that forgetting. But there's a couple of reasons why, even if that's the case, an exit ticket might be really effective. One is as a consolidation task for students and kind of a metacognitive task for students at the end of the lesson, to, you know, cement what they've learned, but also to think, oh, actually, I'm walking out the door, but do I really get this? A second thing is to create, for the teacher to kind of take away and have a resource to create future diagnostics / multiple choice questions for tests and things like that, because it's a great way to collect incorrect responses. And the third thing, and this is what I think you were alluding to in terms of Twitter, for an inexperienced teacher who's not super confident on the content, asking a question at the start of the next lesson is pretty dangerous, because if it reveals a big misconception, you might not know what to do about that,
yeah,
right? You
yeah.
might not be secure enough in the content that you can explain that in three different ways or approach from a different angle or I really identify the source of that misconception. And when you're an early career teacher, you mentioned, Craig, that it took you ages. Let's face it, you're going to be spending ages anyway planning your lessons because you just don't have the content knowledge, right? And you're just, yep. your cognitive load's so high from all the different things of teaching. So I actually think it's better if it's extremely helpful for early career teachers to use exit tickets, because often early career teachers also struggle to do checks for understanding in the time available. There's lots of other things. It's like this one concrete artifact to take away at the end of the lesson. Pause. It's also like a planning aid because it helps them to really get clear about what do I want the students to actually learn in this lesson, which is something that a lot of initial teachers struggle with. So it's like it's this kind of focusing mechanism, and then it gives them that artifact to take away to say, all right, here was one thing I wanted students to learn. Did they actually learn it? And if not, what are their misconceptions and how can I address that next time? And that's just not something that a beginning teacher can do in the moment. So, you know, horses for courses, but I think there are times and places where they're extremely effective. I don't think an expert teacher would necessarily be using them heaps, but they still could use them, particularly for doing things like generating really high quality diagnostic or multiple choice questions.
Right. Okay. Let me two reflections then, a kind of bit of a just push back on one of those things. So, yeah, I like the idea of, I think for a planning tool, they're super important. I talk about this in my Tips for Teachers book, this idea of thinking of a core question. What is a question that if all goes well in this lesson, every single child in this class should be able to ask? And I think that's And I think that's a really useful place to start your planning. And then everything else kind of leads to that. So that helps you design the examples. It helps you design the practice activities and so on. And once you've got that core question in mind, that can be a really good exit ticket. That can be the question you ask kids. And this goes back to what I was saying before. It's not a challenge question. It should be a question that addresses the core objectives of that lesson. So if the kids 5 minutes previously might have been doing some work far more challenging than that because they've got onto the extension work and so on. And then it's kind of like saying, okay, stop what you're doing, everybody. Let's bring it back. The aim of this lesson was that for all of you, you should be able to do this, this, and this. Let's see if we've achieved that aim. Here's a question. So I like the idea of the core question to aid planning and give a bit of direction. The forgetting thing's interesting, right? So I too agree with Adam that a really good time to check kids' understanding is the start of the next lesson, when a bit of kind of forgetting has kicked in. And there's a number of reasons for that, to give that bigger boost in retrieval and storage strength and so on. And also it's more reliable in terms of a measure of understanding than doing it in the moment when kids are surrounded by cues and all that kind of thing. But it goes back to the point that we've discussed today that all right, if a kid gets it right in the moment at the end of the lesson, that's no guarantee that they're going to get it right in the next lesson. But if they get it wrong, it's a pretty safe bet that they're also going to get it wrong the next lesson. So having that information is super useful. So in an ideal world, you're going to do both, right? You're going to assess their understanding at the end of the lesson, and then you're going to assess it at the start of the next lesson. Now, of course, there's time cost to that and so on, but that's probably the most useful thing I think you can do. But my question to you is, Al, if you're into them, if you think they're a useful thing, what format would you go for? Do you think there are certain formats that are more effective or more workload friendly than others? Is it a slip of paper? Is it mini whiteboards? What are you going for there, mate?
Yeah, so I think a slip of, I mean, it depends upon the technology of your school, right? So like tech can work really well for it. Slips of paper can work well. I haven't thought about, the last time I thought about exit tickets was when I was doing a rewrite of the StepLab sequence. I've actually just pulled that up to help me remember what I actually thought about. so here are some of the tips that we've written in there. Keep to core content. Mm-hmm. So we want to like design them with a laser-like focus. Another one is, this is a key one, design for quick analysis. So you want to actually be targeting misconceptions if possible. And so this is why your diagnostic questions would be really good as exit tickets, Craig, because it allows a teacher to quickly look at them and analyze, like, in a heartbeat, what's going on. A third idea is like specifying a threshold for success. So students might, and this is less relevant in maths when it's like right or wrong, but in other like more writing-based subjects, thinking about what do I actually want to see? What's going to help me see this is successful and what isn't? Thinking about the criteria a little bit more. Something relates to what we were talking about earlier was ensure independent completion, because if you don't do that, you've basically lost everything, and they're completely useless. And then the idea, and this is from Harry Fletcher Wood's book, Responsive Teaching, the idea of divide, dig, and decide. So this is his way of like really quickly and efficiently sorting them. So if you've got them where they're designed for quick analysis, I mean, if it's like a multiple choice question, you don't need to do this divide, dig, and decide process. You just like look through and you can immediately see. But if it is like a written thing, you can quickly sort them into a couple of piles, which are like right goes in one pile, you forget about that. You know, incorrect goes in another pile. And then the dig is you pick only a couple of them and really analyze them more deeply and then decide what to do, how to adapt your lesson in response.
That's good.
Another thing you can do that is often overlooked is just because you collect every student's exit ticket doesn't mean you have to look at every student's exit ticket, right? So you might even think, oh, I'm pretty sure Craig had it. I'm not sure Josie got it, and I'm like almost 100% sure that Trent didn't get it. So I'm just going to take those three and see if my general sense of what was happening in the class was on, and if it is on, that's great. Or you might say, okay, I'm particularly worried about these five students. I'm just gonna collect theirs, and as I collect them, you know, a quick way to do that is if you collect them one by one, you can just put them all on the bottom, and everyone else goes on top, and then it's like everything else goes in the bin as soon as the students left, and you've got those five in your hand, so you don't have to sort through it later. So there's a few kind of tricks you can do. Obviously, you probably don't want to do that all the time, but you know, if you know you are short of time, parent teacher that night, and you're not gonna have time to really go through all of them. There are a few things you can do to cut down on time there.
Good tips. Love it all. Fantastic. Right, so we're going to sign off now for our kind of main podcast listeners. Just the usual kind of plugs. What do you want to plug? When's this book out? Have you got a date for this yet?
No, March some point. Don't know.
Soon, mate. Next month.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That's next month. Fingers crossed. I don't know. I'm struggling to get a date out of John Catt. John Catt. Give us a date, please. But yeah, I'm told it will be out in March. So really, really excited about that. And yeah, we've got an online course in the classroom on effective classroom management that heaps of people have signed up to so far, which is awesome. And we've had like lots of really enthusiastic responses to that as well. People completing it really quickly and saying it's really helped them so far. So if people are keen for the content earlier and potentially also going a little bit deeper than the book, and in a format that you can listen to just like this podcast, then yeah, if you just jump onto ollielovell.com, there's a link there.
What's the title of the book, mate?
The Classroom Management Handbook.
Perfect. And you'll be hopefully coming on my main pod. We'll do a deep dive on that as well.
That'd sure. Be, yeah, that sounds
that'd
great.
Be that'd be great. And my usual plug is my newsletter, so Tips for Teachers, 30-second read every Monday with a quick fire tip. And my ED newsletter on Tuesday, I've started a new series. You'll be loving this all. So I've done my Developing a Departmental Approach to series, where I did the Do Now, Worked Examples, Review and Answers, and Problem Solving. I'm starting up a new series, which is going live. It'll be live when this podcast goes out. Looking at some of my favorite activity structures and sharing some tips to get the most out of them. So I'm going to start with Venn diagrams. Everyone loves a Venn diagram. So I've got 10 ideas how to get the most out of that high value activity structure. I'm going to do SSDD problems. I'm going to do intelligent practice, just 10 practical ways to kind of get the most out of those. So if you're interested in that, head to my Mr. Barton Maths /newsletters and you can sign up for free for those. Right. Oh, so lovely speaking to you as ever, and see you next time.
See you then, Craig.